Welcome to episode 6 of Parallel Lines.
What do you want to talk about today, Tony? There's been quite a lot going on, hasn't there?
Well, when we recorded episode 5, it was just before the election. And we put it out after the election, so it was, we were guessing which way the result might go. I mean, who knew? Who knew?
Well, I suppose everyone knew, didn't they? So we were told. But we were sat there with our esteemed guest, Joe Kay, with a face that kind of looked horrified that we might talk about the election. And we sort of said, don't worry, we're not presupposing anything. We're just saying that chronologically it will have happened by the time we put this episode out. And yeah, the result was what everybody was expecting. So we now have a Labour government who are publicly on track towards renationalising the railway, is their stated position.
Fix it fast. And people are cautioning on this fix it fast thing because, as people are reminding us, John Major privatised it fast.
Mm.
Despite a lot of people saying, don't run before you can walk, boss, because you might make mistakes, you might not do it the best way. And he did it fast to show that he was clever. And so one thing that's worrying people is the desperation to prove we really are doing it. Because remember the last Labour government, when Blair was elected, they promised that they would take the railways back and they didn't do anything. So this time there's a definite, we've got to prove we're really doing it.
Yeah. And, well, maybe a more positive way we could look at it in terms of that pace is to say, what does fast mean on the railway? I mean, you know, when we have things like project speed and moving at pace on the railway, it very rarely means anything happening particularly fast, doesn't it? So we might not need to worry too much. I think the main thing is that we've got action. We've got determined people who want to do things differently. So I think we can be pretty confident that change is going to come. I don't think it's going to be like the Blair era, do you? I think they're going to do stuff. We're further along the journey than ever. We've got things on the legislature, you know, that are coming up in terms of the legislative agenda. So we've had speeches in Parliament before they broke up, which is pretty quick, you could say, that they got that in before the recess. So I think it looks like we're going to see action fairly soon.
Yeah, I suppose the worry is, and people remembering the beginning of the Blair era will remember that John Prescott was looking after transport and he was given money to spend over 10 years to make the railways better, and he spent it all in the first year fixing things, and then they sort of looked in the pot and said, oh, there's nothing left to fix things now. So and this time there isn't a pot of money anyway, it appears, and things are being cancelled. And again, the concern is that the haste might have killed a few things off that were quite a long way down being planned already, like the Portishead line reopening, which they've needed in Bristol, and it serves a lot of housing that's already there and a market that's already there, and they've spent the tens or hundreds of millions planning. And you think, maybe we need to finish some of the things that are already down the line because we've already proved that there's a need. But the mixture of the Chancellor saying, I can't even find any money down the back of the sofa kind of thing, and the desperate need to be seen to be doing things.
Yeah, so isn't there a worry there as well that, I mean, this certainly worries me, that we talk about and we hear about the positives that are going to come from this change that is planned in terms of efficiencies and in terms of, you know, simplification, and that's going to lead to money down the line. But as you say, there isn't any money to spend up front. And I worry that people think the change happens for free when actually it doesn't, does it? Making this change happen, it needs people, it needs, you know, you either need to divert people away from what they're doing now, or you need to have more people to do it for them. But, you know, probably a combination of both, because you want the right people. But that all costs money, doesn't it? So we're not talking about money in the sense of, you know, steel in the ground or, you know, building things, but money in terms of, there isn't anything in this life that happens for free, is there? So all these contracts that need bringing back in-house, all these different ways of working that need implementing, where's the money for that? I don't really see where that's coming from. It worries me a little bit, that.
Yeah. And as we discussed on the phone the other day when we were preparing for today, a lot of people that were surveyed before the general election who backed renationalisation of railways. I can't say renationalisation, so we'll have to find a new word for it. Taking back control.
Ooh.
That's never been used before, has it? Take back control of the railways. Get railways done. There we go. A lot of people who were in favour of it thought two things would happen. They thought that suddenly all the trains would be punctual, and they thought that their fares would tumble, because of these evil privateers that have been ripping the railways off and shoveling money into their banks. And for
by the
some
way, there's air quotes around all of that, Tony.
Yeah, sorry. I'm saying this is what they thought, They thought this. And they thought that the private operators were only concerned with making money and not running the trains on time. So
you take them out of the equation and those two things happen. Yeah. Trains run on time, people pay less for tickets. Yeah. When actually, are we sure that's going to happen? Mm. Do we think that... I mean, there's a difference between correlation and causation here, isn't there? That those things can both be true or not true, actually. And yet, will it lead to reduced fares and will it lead to increased punctuality? On the punctuality one, I'm less than expert in fares policy, but on punctuality, what worries me is the distraction factor. If we're all distracted, bringing things in-house, doing things differently, etc., doing reform for the next few years... Who's keeping an eye on the railway? Like Joe Kay said in our last episode, that naughty toddler who's, you know, gone a bit quiet and is up to something in the other room, are we going to see a dip in performance? And then how will people feel about this grand plan that they, you know, this dream that they were sold almost, that things were going to get better and quick, which is what they're now being told. If it doesn't happen quick and it doesn't happen at all, where does that leave us? You know?
And on the fares thing, there are two things that always stick in my mind. Before COVID, a year or two before COVID, one of the three unions had commissioned a report. What would renationalisation save? And they got a headline figure. And it was that over 5 years, renationalisation will save £1.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was at a time when there were 1.5 billion journeys a year. So
I see where you're going with this.
20p a journey.
Mm.
That's what it would save.
And we've got fewer journeys now, don't we?
Yeah.
If anything. So, and a bigger black hole in the finances. So where does that leave you?
Yeah. So even if COVID hadn't happened, according to one of the unions who was calling for renationalisation, their sums said that it might be able to knock 20 pence off a journey, which, okay, that's averaged, whatever, might take a pound off your journey to London and 5p off your journey to work.
Mm.
And that was their numbers. And, you know, other people have suggested maybe the profit margin's sort of 12 to 15p a journey. So either way, whatever happens, I don't think we're going to see fares tumbling.
Mm.
One of the senior people who were involved in putting the railways into their new guise, and I won't name which one, I gave a lift to many years ago and got lectured for the journey. We got a lift back, by the way, because we'd been to a place where there was a railway blockade on because they were digging a new tunnel, so we couldn't get the train back. So it wasn't a railway person going by road to
an event.
It
wasn't a faux pas.
No. Well, it was a faux pas on there because they'd gone by taxi and then they realised they hadn't sorted out how to get back to work afterwards. Mm. And I said, I've come in a car because you're not running any trains. And I got lectured for the half-hour journey back into Manchester about if we want fares like the rest of Europe, it's the taxpayer that has to contribute. And I said, just out of interest, you know, the whole saving money thing, if you took all the profit out of the railways, as a railway manager, what do you think it would do? And they said it would take us back about one fare increase.
So, not much that,
so
is it?
So the annual fare increase is the profit margin. So if you're out there and you're thinking, I voted particularly in the election because I thought my trains would get more punctual and my fares would fall, you probably didn't read the rest of the manifesto. And this is the concern that people might get very unhappy very quickly. The back end of that very lengthy conversation bit is people might be very quickly dissatisfied because it's not going to change. And the rail minister and the transport minister will be blamed for not immediately sorting everything out.
Totally true. And bit of a kind of teaser for upcoming episodes of Parallel Lines. We've got some pretty fantastic guests on to talk about some of this stuff. So we're going to be talking to Roger Ford, who is frankly a legend of railway kind of thinking and commentary. And, you know, he understands a lot of the kind of under the bonnet stuff on some of the stuff you've just kind of touched on there, Tony, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Where those costs are, what's driving them, you know, different cost models you could have. So that's going to be fascinating to get into that with him. I'm also really pleased to say that we're going to have a fantastic guest on the political side of things, in the form of Mr. Ollie Glover, MP, which he is now, Member of Parliament for Didcot and Wantage, recently elected, former railway manager like myself. We started on the same graduate scheme. And he, much like myself, has worked on different sides of the railway, Network Rail and the talks, and he's got so many views on things. So we're going to get a bit of that political insight. Now, he is a Lib Dem MP, so he's not going to be, you know, in the cabinet on these matters. But you know, they've got a huge presence in Parliament now, so I expect him to have a lot to say. And in his maiden speech, he mentioned the railways, and then he managed to get on his feet in the first debate on the Railways Act. So I feel like he means business, Tony, and he's going to be, you know, really into telling us about how he thinks this is going to go and some of that stuff about how fast and, you know, and when things are going to happen. It's going to be fascinating, isn't it?
It is. And actually, MPs that aren't right at the centre of it are really good at asking the awkward questions. That's the good thing. During the last Parliament, I got two or three really awkward questions asked by Caroline Lucas, the Green MP, Brighton, who's very interested in transport and was very open to dropping in the odd awkward question, as long as I could give reasons why this would be a useful awkward question. And there are several in there that I sort of helped her assistant write. But it was brilliant because they're not in the middle, so they're not trying to defend what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they're not in the middle of opposing it, where they're seen just to be awkward because that's the job of the opposition. And having members of the third parties, as it were, group asking questions sometimes is really good because they're the ones that can sit down, do a bit of research and say, OK, for non-political reasons, just tell me what you're doing, what's going on, why aren't fares coming down, or why are you, after COVID, there was an awful lot of, why are you still controlling things so heavily, why aren't you letting the railway try and sort itself out, etc.
Yeah, and I think sometimes the person who is holding the brief, so to speak, you know, has different pressures, you know, because they are in the cabinet and, you know, they have got a place in the cabinet to try and defend and, you know, all the rest of it. Some of the really great people we've had over the years. So we think of Hugh Merriman. Before he was ever a rail minister, he was on the periphery, wasn't he? And he was a really great select committee chair for transport and, you know, really highly thought of. And I think a lot of that reputation he built up was from when he was on the edges, actually. And it's a shame almost that he got that position towards the end of the last government rather than earlier on, because could he have done more if he'd been there for longer? We'll never know. But a lot of the good stuff he did was on the fringe rather than, you know, really in the depths of it. So yeah, and I find all that politics stuff fascinating anyway. You know, my undergraduate degree was politics. I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to all that stuff. So yeah, be prepared for a bit of geek out from me.
There's a great thing, isn't there, that they say generally that the danger with a politician who gets a brief, the civil servants are wary of them going native. They start to like the thing that they're looking after. And this has happened with several rail ministers or transport ministers over the years, that they've gone from supposedly having a slightly hands-off overview of things to getting excited. Somebody's taken them for a cab ride, and then somebody else has said, I won't mention an MP, but a rail minister going back several years had been with their family on the sleeper and was suddenly a fan of the sleeper trains and kept telling everyone what this marvellous experience was. And you could feel the minders around going, this minister's starting to go native. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, not long after that, minister was no longer a rail minister. And that is the danger of something that people that come in from outside the industry anyway to work in it. So I've kind of got gripped by this and I've got passionate for it. And that's not always a good thing, because you might be passionate for the wrong thing. You might end up trying to defend things that really need sorting and not seeing that other things need sorting. And so this is interesting. So again, it's probably good to have someone who's worked in the industry as an MP, who's not actually right in the middle of it, who can, who's been native, but can warn if ministers are starting to get too embedded in there and getting too involved in the wrong way with it. And what the industry needs now really is politicians to let go anyway, isn't it? This is what all the managers say. Is we don't want them phoning up and saying, you've spent £300 on a what? You know, which is what happened during COVID. You know, if you want to spend more than £250, you've got to get the minister's permission or whatever.
And we've moved away from that tight control now, I think, or we're beginning to. But there's a long way to go, isn't there, Tony? We're nowhere near this vision of everybody, you know, being under the banner of GBR, and all the contracts will, let's be honest, take years to bring in. And then one of the things that we'll get onto with Ollie that he mentioned in his speech on the floor about the Railways Act, is that there's actually really big parts of the industry that aren't even mentioned in the Railways Act. You know, we might talk to Roger about this. We're not even talking about the rolling stock side. It doesn't even touch it.
Yeah.
You know, so again, this dream of, you know, British Rail style, everybody in one big family together, it's a bit of a misnomer, isn't it?
It's that thing, you come up with a solution to the problem before you know what the problem is, kind of thing. So they came up with this brand, the Great British Railway brand, which feels great, and it feels great. And it's because it's great in front of it, so it's one better than British Railway. But a lot of people are also popping up and saying, you do remember all the problems that British Rail had that we kind of buried, that weren't sorted. It wasn't perfect.
Mm.
And the summer has been interesting to show us what publicly owned national railways can do. And it hasn't been perfect either. Germany let down an awful lot of people during the Euros with cancellations and disruption. You know, teams that were supposed to be getting to matches and not able to get on the train and having to hire a bus or a plane at the last minute to get across. And there were problems in France. I know some of them were vandals or whatever you want to call
it. Of course, some of that was sabotage. But the Germany example, I mean, I know people who were at the Euros using rail to travel to the Euros who, you know, we often talk about this. You just mentioned it before, the tension between fares and taxes and how they do it in Europe. And their view was, I'd rather have paid more if it had actually worked. And actually, I think that's at the root of where we are with things like fares, is that I heard this mentioned the other day about taxes in general in this country and things like the NHS. People don't mind paying a bit more if it works.
Yeah.
It's not the cost itself. It's not, you know, the number that is actually the terrible thing. Of course, we'd all like to pay less for everything. Mm. You know, we'd all like to pay less for a pint of milk. But you feel really aggrieved if you pay however much for a pint of milk and it's off the next day.
Yeah.
You know, what you really want is to get what you pay for. And people don't feel like they're getting what they're paying for at the minute. That's the problem, isn't it? I don't actually mind paying 150 quid to get to London, more, you know, 350 quid sometimes. But if it was an absolutely cracking service that was on time, that I could rely on, that, you know, everything was sparkly clean and every toilet flushed and, you know, everybody had a smile on their face and had wonderful customer service, etc., etc., you'd turn around and go, well, that felt like really good value for money.
Yeah.
Actually, I'd do that again. They don't feel like that now.
No. And there's a slight concern even that there's been a very disaffected workforce for various reasons. And however you feel about the strikes and the disputes, for some to not have had a pay settlement for 5 years is a difficult thing, because that starts to back up. And some of these eye-watering numbers that are in the papers, just remember when they've, you know...
Oh, my God, can we just talk about the 15% for a minute, Tony?
Because it's aggregated over 5 years.
Yeah. It's not 15%. Some of them haven't had a pay rise for 5 years. So if you divide the 15% down over the 5 years, it's really not that much.
Yeah.
We need to stop talking about 15%. It's terrible.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate, because obviously certain parts of the press were going to conflate it to one big number because that's their job, is to make people angry about things that are happening now. And they did that very well. And so it is important to remember that people, and particularly as we were talking about on the RBF the other week, that there are people on the lowest pay scales that have really been struggling already, and they're also 5 years behind on what they're owed. And that was on not much more than cost of living, the cost of living their lives from their wages. So that's been all unfortunate. It's possibly been unfortunate that there is some thinking that the rush to get the job done, to get a settlement, to get it all signed off, meant that the elephant in the room that we keep mentioning, you know, some of the working practices probably need to change. And the fact that that wasn't addressed at all, even a promise to talk, even an acceptance that
there could be room for improvement.
Yeah. Maybe that was done too hastily to get the look, we can do it job. And all it's done is to still leave the elephant in the room and other employees in other unions who didn't get such a good pay deal are now saying, well, if we can have a pay deal that big and no strings attached, that's what we'll be going for. So it's the new government accused the last one of kicking the can down the road on a lot of things. And actually what it's done is to give at least one of the cans an almighty kick.
Yeah.
Which won't make it easy when you're trying to harmonise lots of companies and bring them all back together.
How do you rein that in? How do you bring back some sort of steady approach to wage inflation, and how do you bring back the debate about terms and conditions? How do you bring that back to the table when you've essentially, it appears, and you know, we weren't in the room, we don't know what's written down in the deal, but from what we can gather, they've taken that off the table for this deal. It's not part of it. So how do you bring it back into the room without falling out again?
Yeah,
because that's not what we want. We don't want to end up and you know, the LNER thing just 48 hours afterwards is a sign that things aren't resolved. There are still a lot of issues that the two sides need to variously work through until we get to a place of genuine, you know, harmony between the unions and the employers. the new employers in that case, because, you know, LNER is a nationally operated train operating company. We can't dress this up any other way. They haven't fallen out with one of the private operators. If they had, you might have gone, oh, well, the reason they've done that 48 hours afterwards is to try and hasten the bringing in house of a private operator. Well, it's not that. They've fallen out with LNER. So what does that tell us then? That there's still big, deep-rooted issues that the two sides just don't agree on. And so we've got to work that through. We can't just sweep that under the carpet, can we? We're kicking cans down the road. We're sweeping things under the carpet. What next?
Well, we're running out of... We need a new department of metaphors if we're not careful. But there's some big things there that need to be resolved going forward. Just a thought. I woke up in the middle of the night
and, with
a thought. When you get to my age, you wake up in the middle of the night quite a lot, but we won't go into that today. I thought there is still a section of the railway fraternity that thinks that they should be paid more to go to work on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Some don't now, and some accept it's different. But there's still a volume, because I've read it on the forums this week.
We might refer to them as a sizeable minority,
yes,
perhaps.
There we go. So I just thought, the thing is, you're taking people to supermarkets on a Sunday that charge the same price as the rest of the week, with people paying the same fare that they did the day before, and the supermarket staff that are serving you are getting paid the same as they did the other days of the week. And the people that are going to football matches on a Sunday are paying the same ticket price as they would if the match was on a Saturday or a Friday or a Monday. And all those other things round it. So why is Sunday different to you?
Where's the justification?
Because everything else in life is the same price on a Sunday.
And the world has moved on. So you just aged yourself talking about insomnia there. So I'll age myself in a different way. So life before railway, my first jobs were in retail. And I was, I think, the last of the generation of people who got paid enhanced money on a Sunday. That died out, you know, 20 years ago. Like, it was a thing when Sunday opening was a new thing, and they had to, you know, tempt people to work on a Sunday, had to sell it to the workforce and what have you. But they fairly quickly moved through natural attrition and, you know, new contracts to bringing people on to it just being the norm. So if I was applying for a retail job now, you get paid what you get paid. Just the way it is. We've kind of missed a trick there somewhere along the line, haven't we? Because we haven't done that with all railway staff. And, and you're right to point out that it isn't everyone, but there is... There's a fairly sizable community of people who've retained that privilege, and it is becoming harder and harder to justify retaining it, other than they have a very strong position to just say, well, that's my contract and you can't change it, which is true, of course. But is it justified? And does it get us? This is the question I think is fundamental. Does it get us to a better railway? And what are those people doing in holding that attitude and holding on to that view? What are they doing to better the railway, which ultimately is what we all need to do to make the railway sustainable and to keep their jobs, our jobs, all of us? You know, it, ultimately, it has to continue to be a better and better railway. And I don't know how that adds to that.
So that's just some unpacking of our thoughts in the post-election brave new world that we now face. And, you know, it's only 4 years and 10 months before people can decide whether they've liked you or not anyway.
Whether they got what they paid for.
And we're going to hear in the next few days it's going to take at least 10 years to change the railways to the way they want it. So who knows, in 5 years' time somebody else might pop up who's going
to... We just don't know, do we?
So welcome to those in the middle. But meanwhile, we have to plan for some more episodes, so let's go and do that.
As ever, we are really interested in hearing from you. Some of the guests that we've had on recently have been as a result of suggestions, if not directly, then just got us thinking, and we've got people to come on. So if you know of anybody you'd like us to speak to, or any topics you'd like us to delve into in our musings, please email us at contact@pwllines.com. That's contact@pwllines.com.